Yeah, thank you so much, Jim and Francois, for including me in this program at this late moment. And so it is partly for that reason that I don't have a PowerPoint. And I apologize for reading off my screen. I also want to especially thank Jim, who I met through a mutual friend when he came and gave a lecture at Purdue about a little over a year ago, and then extended a very lovely invitation to me to come to his center, which was great. So thank you again for your support. I also just want to quickly apologize for missing the discussion this morning. I'm sort of wearing 8 different hats during my time here in France, and I'm currently doing field work for my second book. Okay, so I wanted to just kind of quickly offer some brief remarks and provocations in response to the France chapter. Perhaps it's a few more caveats or sort of by way of introduction. Perhaps it's obvious, but I am American. But I've spent a lot of time studying France, living in France, and that's the bulk of my empirical research, particularly as it relates to issues of international migration. So I'm primarily a sociologist, not just of international migration, but also of sort of issues related to culture, which I'll get to in a second, and race and ethnicity. So that's sort of, speak louder?
No.
Oh, I'm too loud. Oh, that's so funny. Okay, sorry. Okay, this is better. Okay, sorry. That was funny. I thought I was gonna have the opposite problem. Yeah, so that's deeply sort of informs kind of how I approach a lot of these issues. And then I also want to just clarify that maybe sort of in contrast to other people here, I'm an ethnographer. So the bulk of my empirical work relies on thick description, participant observation, and interviews as well. So maybe that'll all be obvious as I speak. And then I also wanted to kind of clarify that I'm speaking about these issues these issues of migration in France, but I'm very deeply disturbed by what's currently happening in the United States, well, around a lot of issues, more relevant to this discussion, the U.S. border crisis and the concentration of children. And so that's sort of also kind of what I'm thinking about as I think about these issues. So first I want to say that I agree with Jim and Francois' remarks about how we cannot understand sort of any kind of dynamic, phenomena, et cetera, as it relates to French society, either sort of, in the contemporary sense or historically, without understanding French republicanism and republican ideology. I think it's hard to think about a way to overstate the relevance in understanding sort of contemporary dynamics in French society. And so I sort of appreciate their attention to that point. And then also to the point of sort of the need to always consider the distinction between the kind of rhetoric of immigration and the actual numbers, which I think Francois just very helpfully pointed out. So my own empirical focus as it relates to migration in France focuses on second generation migrants. So children of, primarily Maghrebin or North African immigrants living in France, people who were born and raised in France to parents from these former French colonies. And so as my work is ethnographic, I'm really influenced by Patrick Simon's trajectory or gene study, which gives us a really, I think, really, really rich and robust view of the entire second generation population, which I'm sure he would talk about if he were in my seat, but I'm here, huh? So I see a lot of my ethnographic work as really a sort of complement or qualitative complement, if you will, to what I think he and his team does with his large-scale quantitative study, which I understand that they're currently doing the 10-year version of, or the 2019 version of. So what I think is important to keep in mind when understanding questions of second-generation immigrants in France more generally is sort of the issues of sort of societal belonging and inclusion, which I'm very interested in. So not just sort of thinking about citizenship or belonging in terms of a legal status, but also the degree to which people feel that they're fully included or incorporated in French society. So my own perspectives on these issues, or what I talk about in my book, tries to get us to move away solely from focusing on frameworks of integration and assimilation when we understand the experiences of second generation and subsequent generation immigrants. Because again, as what repeatedly came up in my ethnographic work, was that these are people who see themselves as French and see themselves fully, they fairly much identify as French. And I should have said earlier, I focus on the middle class segment of the second generation population. So these are individuals that often are well educated and have professional kinds of jobs, but nonetheless feel they're continually reminded of how they're not fully included in French society. And so I think that that's something that for that migration scholars more generally should pay more attention to. And then I think it's also important to consider the question of how much it, you know, in contemporary French society, how much it matters to be sort of a descendant of immigrants versus a sort of ethnic minority, you know, writ large. So when we get to this point of, I mean, I focus on the second generation, but when we get to this point of, you know, third, fifth, tenth generation, I mean, how much are we still sort of speaking to, or how much is it still relevant to speak to this sort of immigrant history? And then sort of related to that, how much does the immigrant history itself matter versus sort of where the immigrants are from or where the immigrant history is from, which is, I talk about a bit in my work with my focus on Maghreban, children Maghreban immigrants, right? So these are children of France's former colonial empire in the Maghreb. And related to that, I would want to add the point of the need to sort of consider questions of colonialism in our discussion of international migration. So I definitely agree with Jim and Francois's point about France not having the same ethos of being a nation of immigrants. But I think, of course, it also has an immigrant history, immigration history, and also has a very entrenched colonial history, which I think colors, you know, excuse the pun, or maybe not, how we understand descendants of immigrants in contemporary French society. And then I'm also sort of struck by how discourses about immigrants and their descendants map onto similar discourses that we can see in the United States and elsewhere. And this is sort of kind of me wearing two different hats as someone who studies France but is, you know, indoctrinated or socialized or what have you, or educated, that's the right word, in the United States. So for example, you know, one of the things that came up that I talk about in my book is this phenomena that second generation Maghrebin immigrants experience of this sort of notion of the perpetual foreigner. So sort of asking someone, for example, where are you from? And they say Toulouse, and they're like, no, but where are you really from, right? And so, and that's very much an idea that comes from, or that we see present in United States discussions of subsequent generation immigrants. So someone who's fourth generation Japanese, it's like, I don't want to hear that you're from San Diego. I want to hear like that you're from Japan, which doesn't make any sense. I bring up that just one example to sort of highlight how I think we can learn a lot from this comparative focus, which is sort of what I do in my work. And then I also just want to say a couple quick remarks about sort of the sort of Muslim or Islam dimension to some of these questions as it relates to France. And so because one of the things I think that came up in the chapter, but maybe less in the presentation, was sort of the effects of, you know, the Charlie Hebdo attacks and the November 2015 terrorist attacks. And, you know, not just sort of the actual attacks themselves, but also sort of the repercussions for people, for members of some of the communities that I study, and sort of how, in many ways, a focus on preventing future terrorist attacks often sort of provides cover for further marginalization of some of the people that I study. And then sort of relatedly, I'd like to bring up the question of, and sort of this is also related to the point I made earlier about colonialism, is the question about race and ethnic difference in France. So I personally, as a scholar of race and racism, and I'm always fascinated, and particularly the comparative part of that, I'm always fascinated by the fact that France doesn't recognize race, which you know, obviously it does the United States, you know, to a crazy degree. But nonetheless, I think what was what's often sort of underlying a lot of these other sort of definitions or descriptions of difference is not just culture, be they culture, religion, or geography, or what have you, is actually a sort of racial and ethnic otherness that I think we can trace back to the French colonial period. So I want to sort of bring that to fore as well. So then I'll quickly just stop to say that, so Jim and Francois end their chapter talking about sort of how the Republican model is still alive and well, and I completely agree with that, and I also want to just clarify that it's also alive and well among immigrants and their descendants. So I think even when we're thinking about the sort of power of this ideology, it's really helpful to keep in mind that this is something that's powerful even to people who might be marginalized by the ideology, and I think that that's also, I think gets at sort of why the national myth is so important in these discussions. Thank you. And sorry for talking so loudly.
Thank you. Yes? Thank you. I shall come back to the paper proposed by Jim and Francois. And I also hint at what you said about the past colonial immigration in France. For the historical background, I have nothing to add, just about the fact that between 1850s to the census of 1975, the European migration in the censuses was in majority compared with non-European immigrants. So the so-called colonial background of immigration is true, but in the past, most during quite more than one century, most immigrants in France were from mostly European countries. I just wanted to add that, and it is a decision of stopping migration in France in 1974, which continued the process of family reunification, which had started before. And the decision was a mix of, coming back to François' text, it was a mix of European decisions. There was no real European policy on migration in this period, but other European countries like Germany in 1973 and Benelux decided in the same night, 1973, to stop migration of labor force, and France profited with a racist struggle in Marseille in order to stop the migration of salaried labor force, not only for labor migration reason, but it is true in a period of change of so-called economic crisis after the whole crisis in European countries. But I shall not stress about that. I wanted to say most that France is always a contre-courant. In a kind of exception compared with all its European neighbors relating to migration, because in the past, France became an immigration land where most European countries were still emigration lands, including Germany in the 19th century, because France was facing with a population decrease in a period of economic growth. And so in a period also where there were few French, except for colonies, which went abroad, France had an immigration story. And the equilibrium, which was settled in 1889, but between right of the blood and right of the soil, allowed that few and then more foreigners became French by birth on the French territories and had easier access to naturalization. So I shall say that France is, as said Dominique Stapper, un pays d'immigration qui s'ignore, an immigration country which doesn't want to be so. And this is still the case now, because France has difficulties to accept itself as an immigration country, which is perhaps the most important point if we compare it to old immigration lands like the US, like Canada, and so, because France is built on the myth of autochthony. It would be another conference. And so the myth of autochthony is still used by extreme rightist parties. And the history of migration in France is not reminded in the family stories, nor in the official story of French building. I shall illustrate this first point to be a contre-courant, an exception, with other examples, and especially in the last period. If we come back to the so-called refugee crisis, France has been slightly impacted by the refugee crisis. between 2011, the beginning of Arab Revolution, and the so-called refugee crisis of 2015. But still now it receives a lot of asylum seekers, much more than other European countries. In 2017, for the first time, France has had 100,000 asylum seekers, and in 2018, France has received 120,000 asylum seekers, which is a lot compared with Germany, with Italy, with Spain, and so on. So it is a kind of exception. And now we have to reintroduce, if we examine the French political making system, the impact of the European immigration and asylum network, because France has always been or tried to be a bon élève, a good follower of European immigration policy. For example, it is in 1993 that for the first time the European rules were introduced in the French law, which is now compulsory. And when Europe, with the Amsterdam Treaty of 1997, has shifted immigration policy topics from the third pillar to the first pillar, justice and home affairs, France has profited in this period to stress on the security approach of migration governance. So now France is one of the biggest immigration countries in Europe, the fifth as for the number of foreigners, and we see this concern to be a bon élève, a good follower of the Brussels, with the answer which was given after the crisis in 2015 and 16, when Juncker said you have to share the asylum seekers according figures that I propose in order to for burden sharing towards Greece and Italy. France accepted with some hypocrisy to welcome newcomers, and the figure which was given by Juncker was you should accept 30,000 newcomers in plus of all the asylum seekers you have every year. And France said yes, but it received just hardly 3,000 newcomers. So France is in the same time in the second rank in the crisis for receiving newcomers, because it is my second point. The newcomers in France are mostly related to history and geography, and so the newcomers during and after the crisis did not come mostly to France, but they arrived to Greece, to Italy, and now to Spain. And it was the same in the past, in the 1990s, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and of the Iron Curtain. France was at the second rank for receiving newcomers. Most of Eastern workers and families arrived in Germany, after in UK in 2004, in Italy, in Spain, and few of them came to France. So France is presenting it as a bon élève, but it is not very strongly concerned with the crisis, all arrivals which are arriving after revolutions and changes in the international political landscape. So France has interest to have strong external borders controlled, but in the same time is avoiding first rank migration, and it has mostly secondary migration flow. The third point is about the shift of the position, the kind of
A contre-courant, also the Sarkozy policy, which was proposed very well analyzed by François Héran in his paper about the launch of the immigration choisie. Some people were saying France tries to have a so-called Canadian policy without really knowing from Sarkozy, from my point of view, the Canadian policy or the factors of this successful Canadian policy, but this policy failed because of the shift of the political landscape. The importance of the right, of the extreme right, had a very strong impact in the shift from this opening migration to so-called skilled people to a policy of closure, stressing on identité nationale, national identity, which failed. Also, the Grenoble discourse on security and the circular Géant, which was prohibiting in 2011 the access to the labor market for students, which is a kind of stupidity, I could say. But in the same time, we cannot say that, as it is suggested in Jim's paper, that the nexus is between liberal approaches and security approaches, because except for the period of the 30 glorious years, the voice of the employers is very difficult to perceive. There are few PhDs on this topic. There is one which was made by Mrs. Enres in the 1990s, but the MEDEF, for example, and other employers, for example, in agriculture, such as FNSEA, have a very low voice in the decision-making process for the needs of newcomers, including migration. Most of them are also in another hypocrisy. They are using these people, but some of them are voting for the extreme right in the same time, especially in the south of France. And so there is some contradiction, because those who are for opening more the borders are mostly activists in association, who are in the same time against the so-called patrons, the firms, the employers, and all the rich capitalist people, all mixed. And in the same time, some of those who are for closing borders are not just the extreme right, but also some trade unionists stressing on the competition on the labor market. And so we are finding the perfect example of Zolberg as strange bedfellows, because those who are for opening the border are mixing the employers and the defenders of human rights for migrants. And on the other side, we find some trade unionists and some extreme right people who are nothing to do together. The last point will be about the recent debates. I think that the most important contradiction, which is the topic developed by Jim, is more between solidarity and security. Because in the last times, with a very strong policy of securitization of migration, which was engaged with the Sarkozy period, but which did not change until now, the debate about solidarity, about human rights, which is defended by a part of the population, which is not a right and left trend, but more between those who are defending the values of human rights on one side, from the extreme left to mix to perhaps a part of the right are against this policy which is negating human rights for refugees, for illegals, for minors, unaccompanied minors, which is now an important part of the newcomers. And it is a very important, it is involving and not very strongly heard part of the society, but it is involving a lot of citizens. But the decision makers, migrant makers, don't hear them because they are so diverse that they have no real advocacy together. And the polls about who is against migration or the right of the rise of the extreme rightist trends are more strong to convince the decision makers to have a very security, very strong security policy towards not only migrants but also refugees, because last law, which was voted in last autumn, is very strong towards the status of refugees and asylum seekers. And in the same time, we have a lot of jobs which are not, which do not find any candidates, and a lot of people who are in very difficult illegal situation. So I shall just finish my paper by saying that first, the public opinion prevails in the decision-making policy in France, preferably to many other arguments. But in the same time, France was to have, with some hypocrisy, a good image, not just in Brussels, but also in the international background on migration. France is signatory of the Marrakesh Global Compact. The US are not, and some other European countries did not sign, but finally it has a policy which does not totally correspond to this beautiful image it wants to have at national and also European and international level. I stop here.
Okay, so Randall Hansen is now our leading academic authority on British immigration and nationality policy. A master of elegant prose with unparalleled intellectual and political astute observations about the rise and rise of British immigration policy. And here he contributes an original and important essay on this vital area of UK policy. The British or largely English response to an engagement with immigration has been appalling for well over 70 years. And in that historical context, the contemptuous dismissal of European citizens of non-UK origin after the Brexit referendum is unremarkable. Disdain for the foreigner is deep and wide. Remarkably, not only did Brexit orchestrate contempt for migrants, but the English managed concurrently to concoct another pernicious colonial legacy scandal in the form of the Windrush generation. As you have seen, both topics are addressed in Hansen's chapter, and I will return to them below. The English antipathy to foreigners and non-whites is glaring. It is animatedly exposed in the Brexit moment. Probably not imbibed by every lever, this antipathy was nonetheless unignorable and pretty widespread. Immigration was a key concern for leavers, that is, those voting to leave the EU, according to the best data polling of public opinion. The ethnographic evidence for bigotry was distressing but unsurprising. Thrilled to wake up having at last told those Europeans to piss off, the ardent Brexiteer could cheerfully instruct long-standing permanent residents, for example, Germans married to British citizens, that they would presumably be packing their bags that afternoon and heading to Stansted Airport, as their legal right to remain had been, as the French would say, terminated. Uninformed about the precise details of Brexit, other leavers assumed that they would also be evicting Asian and Caribbean residents, whether these were first generation or second or third generation migrants, to use that term. This tsunami of built-up resentment first framed by Enoch Powell's River of Blood speech in 1968, and fanned regularly by politicians worried about swamping or marauding or cosmopolitan undesirables, seemed at last to be delivering redemption to these little Englanders. Matching the pomp and patriotism of a final night at the proms, that annual orgy of extreme nationalism, this sea of white Englishness and persons felt redeemed and celebrated at once. Judging by the stream of books by Black or Asian Britons about the challenge of being able to feel they belong, or the demands for integration in the dominant white culture and institutional correlates successfully constitute an often excluding polity. In one of these recent books, Afua Hirsch devotes a chapter to what she calls the question, which I'm sure you know about, it's the one you referred to, that is, where are you from? And, you know, she's from Wandsworth in South London, but that doesn't mean anything to these people. And it's a lovely chapter describing this. Similar tales are, of course, recounted often in the US and in France. These reactions to Brexit and the massive political mobilization, the ambition of getting the UK to leave the EU generated, is comprehensible only by reference to Britain's imperial colonial legacies. Whether they consider themselves absent-minded imperialists, casual purveyors of white superiority, complacent defenders of class hierarchy, or authentic English nationalist racists, the vision of Britain as a white nation really dominates in this sphere. Randall's chapter has many strengths. First, he offers a detailed and lucid analysis of how UK immigration and nationality policy has developed in the 20th century, especially after the Second World War, identifying contradictions and tensions within these two policy trajectories and their course. He unearths a four-stage uneven trajectory of politics policies towards migrants, defined as extremely expansive, equally restrictive, expansive again, and once again, highly restrictive, and sets out a persuasive analytical narrative to understand this trajectory, about which I'll say more below. Second, in an analysis rich in nuance about the nitty-gritty of policy, which affects many people's lives in distressing ways, Hanson provides a timely and detailed account of how the Windrush scandal unfolded, its consistency with inherited UK policy, and what it reveals about Tory politicians evading blame after embracing Martinet aims. So some reflections on the text as on the draft. Randall uses the excellent research he's conducted over two decades to rehearse the essence of UK immigration nationality policy, highlighting key moments and texts such as the 48 Act, and then the laws enacted from the 1970s onwards. First, I think there is one substantive issue which needs to be thought about. From page 16 onward in the text, Randall refers to EU citizens as the numbers of non-UK EU citizens moved to the UK after 2005. And later he notes that by 2015, non-EU migration was down, but EU migration up because of the strength of the British economy. Now, I think it's necessary to reflect on the language and description here, and I think this is a general point, not just about the UK. Is EU migration the right term, since the UK is supposed to be part of a 28-member European Union in which the right of citizenship and freedom of movement is neither legally nor geographically constrained? Does language run the danger of reifying the UK Brexit framework rather than probing it as malicious perversion of legal status? This is one of the extraordinary things about the referendum. Although Brexit hasn't happened yet, overnight it was assumed that people were no longer there by right. I mean, the English never understood the EU, had no idea that someone coming from France or Germany or Romania was just another EU citizen, even though it says it on their wretched passports. So that the dilemma wasn't there. But what happened is that suddenly there was a different status. The issue arises again at page 21, where Randall rightly points out that in a referendum about Europe, which centered on immigration, inevitably, UK state power was limited. There's nothing they could do about immigration numbers because of family and EU movement. And it wasn't that EU citizens were immigrants. They were citizens exercising their right to live within this 28-nation unit, wherever they want. It's like moving from Texas to North Carolina. But this limitation about the status of EU citizens across the 28 member states is not about state policy. Secondly, the account of the hostile environment under Theresa May's reign as Home Secretary sustain, she didn't do PPE, by the way, she did geography at Oxford. It's, that subject has subsequently been closed down since she graduated. Sustained when she made the improbable transition to number 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister is brilliantly recounted by Randall. Both Brexit and this punitive policy regime have ended the movement of non-UK EU citizens to UK, in the effect that, I mean, the EU migration to Britain has just ceased since the referendum. They've had their desired end in that sense. Why would people move there? And many who have lived here are departing. And there's no understanding amongst these policymakers of how successful and prosperous German and French cities are and how urban areas concentrated, you know, around Warsaw, Prague, or Budapest are booming in coming decades. The severe effects of this regime on the so-called Windrush generation is chillingly laid out in the chapter. The new regime's targets were racially non-random, with low-income and black migrants disproportionately affected. One thing you said now, which I don't think you have in the chapter, which is quite right, of the 57,000 people you mentioned, none of them were in a position to have to get a set of ID documents to travel. So they were, I would imagine, none of them earned enough money to ever go for a holiday outside the UK, if they ever had holidays. I think it's worth underlining that. I'd like to see more about migrants and immigration. I would like to see more about how migrants and immigration have been constructed by British intellectuals and the state. As you note on page 26, the most recent immigration debate was as much about white and Christian immigrants from Eastern Europe as it was about non-white ones. Enoch Powell set the dominant motif in his 1968 speech, to which you allude, and which dominated subsequent accounts up to and including some remarkable recent books by Goodhart and Kaufman. I mean, one thing I thought you might want to cite James's book, James Hampshire's book about the 50s and 60s, showing how the Home Office and London Police then were constructing black immigrants as problematic at that time, his archival-based studies. And these engagements in that period lead directly to the sort of current nexus dominated by debates about whiteness. I mean, we have a book about whiteness, celebrating whiteness, you know, and this poor beleaguered minority in Britain, which is getting a lot of attention. By sociology saying they've been unjustly denigrated. So it has lots of echoes of the US. It's the same sort of stuff again. And if you want to get the sense of the argument, there's an op-ed in the Financial Times called White Self-Interest is Not Racism by David Goodhart, expressing this view, in which he argues that racial self-interest may be clannish and insular, but is not the same as irrational hatred, fear, or contempt for another group. I think you might also want to look, and perhaps more generally the audience will want to look, at the resurgence amongst English normative political theories of a devotion to cultural liberal nationalism. In a book, it's subtly entitled Strangers in Our Mist, by the political theorist David Miller, who's a liberal theorist in the Rawlsian sense, he makes the case for barriers against immigration. There's a lot going on there that's quite interesting as well. It's worth bringing that up. Randall wonders how so many British governments fail to understand the consequences of their policies. Hubris, I think, helps answer this question, and the arrogant idea that English racism would never be found out. We really are awfully liberal and tolerant people, you know, that kind of attitude. Didn't the world realize that the term bloody foreigners was really an affectionate expression? I have some smaller points. I don't know... Will your stuff be are you allowing revisions to the chapters?
Yes, we're going to have
some. Okay, so I think one thing to address is, you say there was little recruitment in the Caribbean by the UK government, but I've seen other people say there was a lot, from Jamaica to Pakistan, trying to recruit workers in the 50s, 60s. I think you might want to spell out the 1981 Nationality Act stopped millions of people having a right to enter the UK. Ireland and Irish citizens. I think throughout the text there's a need for a fuller discussion of Ireland and that's the Republic of Ireland and Irish citizens' position. Some reference to the 48 agreement, including the free travel area and so forth, and what that meant is important. And they count here maybe glosses over anti-Irish discrimination and hatred, which was profound in the 50s, as you know. The famous window poster declaiming no blacks, no dogs, no Irish is important at that period, when there was no migration, as you were saying. And the experience of Irish workers, the so-called navvies, is perhaps worth discussing. Many were on the so-called lump system, with unscrupulous employers failing to pay insurance, which left generations of them destitute in old age. The unpleasant Brexit leader, Nigel Farage, always exempts the Irish from his tirades, and the glaring incongruity of East versus West Belfast probably needs unpacking. It just seems to me it's distinct and quite important. A few other things. I'll just come back to finish quickly, to your conclusion. I think you're perhaps too dismissive of critical race theory, especially given your own analysis of Windrush. And this seems to me is the strength of Gilroy, and you know, there ain't no black in the Union Jack. And it seems to me it's not that contradictory given the demographics of this discriminated against group. And think about the Grenfell Tower fire disaster as well, 2 years ago, which didn't elicit much concern from the thread. So anyway, I'll stop there. It's a terrific chapter. I enjoyed reading it enormously. It's extremely clear and informative in the best sense.
Hi, now it's my turn. I will start with your last sentence. It's a very good, very stimulating, very well constructed, very instructive paper. I read so much about Brexit, and that morning when I heard on my radio, Radio Réveil, that they voted for more than 51% for Brexit, I jumped out and I wanted to make sure that I heard it right. Mm. But I didn't run to a battle. And so I really enjoyed very much. I learned very much, but I am an outsider to this topic. I'm not a specialist of the United Kingdom or not an immigration of the United Kingdom. I always refer to the case of the United Kingdom by comparison, since I compare a lot, as you know. Okay, so when you say Brexit, we knew by the discourses, by the press, by the public interventions that migration was important and is an argument, and then you bring like 33% of the leavers who made explicit the immigration issue. There was also in the debate of the exit of the Brexit with Theresa May, there was also the economy, there was also the welfare, there was also border and sovereignty, which has, while the continental Europe is discussing the Schengen, the validity of Schengen, and here you have the Brexit. So I will just comment on your papers. I don't want to bring anything more. I liked also the way that you emphasize on the institutions, on the importance of institutions. And from the institutions, I understand from your paper that they are the big party system and the rhetoric. They are a part of the institutions. And the paper is fascinating to see all this evolution of immigration policy and to see how Labour Party is so much favorable with increasing of human capital and on everything that you showed on the slide here. And and I understand that the logic is the market logic. And you emphasize on that. You said it's a market logic that brings, because it's market shortage and the human capital, and from there will come to education and training of the migrants, etc. And what I don't understand, what is interesting for me is to wonder why conservatives don't take this market logic if this market logic functions for immigration. So there you have the tension between ideology, rhetoric, and market interest that we see so much in the United States today with the new president. New, he's old already. Anyway, so you show all these shifts and expensive, restrictive, which is really very fascinating. And you see the dance of the policy between these two understanding of the logics. So comes the Brexit, and with 2004, and not the Brexit, enlargement with 2004, and EU migrants coming in. And this, as you showed also, that is the most important migration, and they cannot be controlled. But then the question becomes, you have the anti-immigrant hostility, and since you combined already, you combined as an exception for Britain how nationality laws, politics of nationality and politics of immigration are related. And that maybe it's an exception of Britain, but I thought of France, sorry about that. It's because that's true that we came to the citizenship laws in the 1980s when only Le Pen came, and then we started to take, hey, you are French, let's put your Frenchness, and then you have these hearing committees on citizenship laws. And since then, everything that was citizenship law, nationality law, was related, I would agree with you, baby, not to immigration, but to integration. But then my question was, EU citizens were in free circulation, they were in the UK as a part of the EU. So the nationality law that you described since 1948 is not applied to them. Since this nationality law does not apply to them, since there is no question of naturalization for these people in order to remain in Britain, would we think that they are out of Britishness? Since what we are expecting from citizenship and nationality law is also a sort of develop and integration and belonging of this population into it. So they have the right, but they don't have the place. Maybe, I don't know, it's hard to put it. So I thought it was interesting to find. And what is interesting is that what they complain about first is the Roma coming from Eastern Europe. And the Roma is unwanted population in their own country where they are the citizen of, and they are citizens of the Union and the most mobile. And then here's the question of nationality, citizenship is not valid, but the immigration question and non-control of who we want. Maybe we want Slavs, maybe we want Slovak, but we don't want Roma. So that's the interesting aspect. And I thought, so that is my question, actually. You have the nationality aspect, which is a legal aspect. You have the immigration economic aspect. We can bring in also the border aspect, but there is no question of integration, since I will relate the citizenship to the integration question. And you are talking about white Christians that create this hostility environment, white Christians coming from the East. Are we in a sociological rupture with regard to race relations in Britain? And then you say that when you take your theoretical frameworks, you are not very keen to pluralism because you say interpretation is constant, there is nothing new with pluralism. But when you think the way we look at the British case here is multiculturalism is one of the characteristics of the British approach to diversity and is the very foundation of the integration in Britain, I would say. And in 2011, Cameroon started to have this speech on the multiculturalism failed, and it's a failure. We failed to provide a vision of society to which they feel they want to belong. But Cameroon is addressing to Muslim population. The anxiety is not Eastern Europeans who are settled, even though they are not wanted. But the target here is the anxiety of Muslim population. And I know well Tariq Modoud's work, who transposes the race relation issue into, you know, taking Islam as a, you know, aspect of this race relation, how to expand this, not to expand that, but to replace the race issue has become now a religion issue, and religion issue not in the study of secularism, but in the study of integration and make them part of the society. So, and taking Adrian Faber's understanding of Britishness as a part of civilization, I was wondering again, the citizenship of the EU free circulation people are not going to belong to this civilization and to this Britishness. Is it because of nationality law that is not applied to them? Is it because of immigration? Is it of race relations? And then you come back actually with the what is the scandal? And you come back to race relations, but you don't mention that there is a race relation problem that is not resolved yet, but there is this scandal going on in Britain. And this scandal can never happen with EU citizens. They can never be sent back to, they will maybe now, or maybe they will take British citizenship. So if they take British citizenship scenario, of course, they will be a part of this Britishness with time. So there's all these questions that came to my mind reading you, and that I enjoyed, and made me think of many other aspects of Brexit that I haven't thought before. And then I say the challenge now to Britain, with Brexit, I suppose, that it will come, it will be how to manage the free circulation, and what is going to happen with do all these people will become illegal immigrants, and how to manage this illegal immigration. And we haven't mentioned also the free circulation does not only involve the Eastern European people. You have also free circulation people coming to Greece, to Spain, to Italy, they have the free circulation within Europe, and we saw them in the detention camps. And so all these questions will be a new challenge to England with Brexit. As an outsider, that's the way I felt your paper that I enjoyed very much. Thank you.